We want Alaskans to be healthy. We want them to be able to contribute to our economy.
The state makes its case for Medicaid expansion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Yukon Quest mushers adjust to climate change.
Normally dogs like to run at colder temperatures, usually like below zero. So we try to run more at night. So they have those nice cool temperatures, which they tend to like more with their big fur coats.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson unveiled two new reports today at a press conference in Anchorage that she hopes will help make the case for Medicaid expansion. They show Alaska can actually save money by expanding the program, even as the federal match drops below 100%. But whether Republican state lawmakers skeptical of expansion will agree with the analysis is an open question. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson never misses a chance to promote Medicaid expansion, even when that chance comes in the form of a cell phone ringer that someone in the press conference crowd forgot to silence.
Maybe it's somebody calling saying they're ready to sign up, which would be great. We'll be ready this summer.
A lot has to happen between now and this summer, July specifically, when Davidson hopes to roll out expansion. The health department is devoting extra resources to fix big problems with the systems that enroll new Medicaid members and pay providers for services. The biggest obstacle, though, will be Republican state lawmakers who have to approve the receipt of federal Medicaid expansion funds in the budget. Many say the state can't afford to expand the Medicaid program, which is already one of the biggest drivers of the state budget. But Davidson says the new analysis shows Medicaid expansion won't cost the state, even when the federal match drops to 90% in 2020.
We've also identified some pretty significant savings, and Alaska actually saves general fund dollars by covering this new population.
State prisoners, for example, would be eligible for Medicaid expansion, saving the state $4 to $7 million a year, according to the report. The health department would also be able to redirect millions of dollars in grant money that is currently used to help the population who would be eligible for expansion. Davidson also wants expansion to spur the process of reducing the cost of the entire Medicaid program. She thinks the cost savings, combined with overall reform, will convince lawmakers to approve it.
Quite frankly, I think there are some legislators who aren't, you know, necessarily so hot on expansion per se, but they're interested in reform. And so if the two go in hand in hand and we can show that there are savings to the state in a time where we are looking for those savings opportunities in our general fund, then I believe that they'll come on board.
Republican legislators declined to comment until they had more time to review the reports. Earlier Friday, Senate President Kevin Meyer said he was open to Medicaid expansion if it didn't cost the state any money. In the coming weeks, lawmakers will be hearing from a long list of organizations that support expansion, including the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The organization is pledging $1.6 million for the first year of expansion to cover the state's share of administrative costs. Jeff Jesse is the chief executive officer with the trust, which serves Alaskans with substance abuse problems, mental illness, and cognitive disabilities. He says it makes sense for the trust to help out because expansion will benefit Alaskans the group serves.
Well, the trustees certainly had to think about the cost issue, but that is the purpose of the Mental Health Trust, is to be a catalyst for change and to assist in enhancing our service system for our beneficiaries. So this is a very appropriate project for the trust.
The trust is also giving $300,000 to the health department to pay national experts to study successful Medicaid cost reform efforts in other states. About 40,000 mostly childless adults would be eligible for Medicaid expansion. But in the first full year of implementation, according to the new report, only half of those who are eligible would sign up. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
A new report released by the Matsu Health Foundation indicates that behavioral health services in the Matanuska-Susitna borough are woefully inadequate. The report, the first of three, suggests residents are not accessing care until they are in crisis. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The report, issued in late January, presents some disturbing statistics. It focuses on a crisis response system that falls far short of meeting current needs. Elizabeth Ripley is executive director of the Matsu Health Foundation, which operates Matsu Regional Medical Center. Ripley says the hospital is doing double duty.
Even though it doesn't offer psychiatric services, it's the number one purveyor of behavioral health care in our community.
Ripley says the hospital's emergency room is handling thousands, 2,300 cases alone in 2013, of drug and alcohol cases a year, cases the hospital is not equipped to deal with.
Our emergency department sees five times the number of behavioral health visits than our community mental health center.
And the cost. Matsu Regional Hospital charged services totaling $23 million in 2013, and much of that went unpaid due to inadequate insurance coverage or no insurance coverage at all on the part of the patients. Matsu Health Foundation conducted a health needs assessment for the Matsu area a couple of years ago. That survey pointed to alcohol and substance abuse and mental issues, collectively referred to as behavioral health, as the top health concern in the Matsu. Data was collected from 65 interviews with crisis responders in all fields, health, law enforcement, and first responders, and through public forums.
And we heard at those forums that people were waiting 90 to 120 days, particularly children, to get a mental health appointment. We heard from adults about the struggles of accessing care specific to mental health or substance abuse services. And we chose to look at the crisis response system specifically because when you look at why are people presenting to the emergency department, it shows where or how they might not be accessing services in the community to prevent the crisis.
Alcohol and drug abuse is a factor in half of Matsu suicides and homicides, and 20% of Matsu high school students said they have considered suicide. Matsu's suicide death rate is twice the national rate, and crisis response costs law enforcement an extra $1.6 million. Ripley says the State Department of Health and Social Services is responsible for providing behavioral health services through state-operated programs. The agency's Division of Behavioral Health provides grants designed to address community needs for crisis response, but Ripley says the grant system is not working for Matsu.
In the last 15 years, our population has doubled from 50,000 to almost 100,000 people, but the funding for our community mental health center has stayed flat.
Albert Wall, director of the Department of Behavioral Health, says he's read the report and appreciates the work Matsu Health Foundation has put into research and assessment. Wall says his department is looking for ways to improve service delivery in the state.
There are many challenges the state takes into account when awarding grants. And of course, the high cost of care in rural areas is one of those issues which does not make a strict population-based approach the most effective method of making grant amount determinations.
Wall says Matsu's rapid growth will be taken into account in the coming grant cycle and that he looks forward to working with Matsu providers on the issue. Ripley also points out that expanding Medicaid could help many of the more than 2,000 Matsu residents who have some type of mental illness. She says until the problem of funding is solved, the status quo won't change.
Right now, the emergency room physicians at Matsu Regional essentially have two places they can send someone, home or to Alaska Psychiatric Institute.
Ripley says Matsu Regional routinely diverts patients in need to an Anchorage facility. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
More than a decade after the original crime took place, the Alaska Supreme Court denied Rochelle Waterman's appeal of her conviction in the death of her mother. Waterman was found guilty in a 2011 retrial of criminally negligent homicide for telling two men she had been dating that she wanted her mother dead and then failing to warn her mother or alert authorities when she found out that the two men were indeed planning to kill Lori Waterman. The two former boyfriends, Jason Arendt of Klawock and Brian Riddell of Thorn Bay, confessed to the 2004 murder, which took place outside of Craig on Prince of Wales Island. For her role in the crime, Waterman was sentenced in July of 2011 to 3 years in prison. The basis of Waterman's appeal is that as a 16-year-old, she should not have been judged based on the standard for an adult. Waterman's attorneys argued that juveniles' brains are not yet fully developed, which affects their judgment. Alaska's High Court said state law stipulates that for the most serious crimes, including homicide, defendants as young as 16 years old are treated the same as adults. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, considering the future of fishing on the Kuskokwim River.
If you're not united, you'll never accomplish nothing. Right now, we are not united.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
Governor Bill Walker's administration is seeking more time to assess the potential impact of expanding Indian country in Alaska. The Alaska Dispatch News reports State Attorney General Craig Richards is asking for a six-month delay in a case before a federal appeals court in a long-running battle affecting tribal sovereignty. In 2013, the District of Columbia Appellate Court ruled in favor of four Alaska Native tribal governments and one individual who sued the U.S. Interior Department. The appellate court ruling led to an Interior Department rule to accept land into trust for Alaska tribes and individuals with native allotments. Interior is not appealing, but the state is. Plaintiff's attorney Heather Kendall Miller says the Interior Department's ability to put land into trust for Alaska natives is thus on hold. Efforts to establish tribal co-management of Kuskokwim salmon are slowly progressing. A steering committee is in Bethel to sketch out the future of who regulates the river. As KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, Kuskokwim fishermen are eager to be managers instead of simply advisors.
10 members of a steering committee met for the first time in Bethel Thursday. Fishermen from Nikolai at the headwaters down to the mouth began to define what they want to see in tribal co-management. Committee member Bob Aloysius of Kalskeg emphasized tribes need to be more than simply advisors.
Recommendations go to a point and there nothing happens. But we need to have authority to implement and maintain, monitor, and enforce whatever we come up with.
The steering committee for the Kuskokwim River Intertribal Fisheries Commission is being facilitated by the Association of Village Council Presidents and Tanana Chiefs Conference, building off tribal resolutions passed last year. Kuskokwim king salmon runs have been in decline for several years, and unprecedented restrictions have hit subsistence fishermen hard. That's led to conflicts among communities along different parts of the river. Jacob Black from Napakiak said for tribal management to succeed, everyone has to be on board.
Our elders used to say, there might be a lot of you from Kuskokwim or Alaska, but if you're not united, you'll never accomplish nothing. That's 100% true to me. Right now, we are not united.
The full commission someday would include representatives from all Kuskokwim tribes choosing to take part. The smaller steering committee is trying to determine next steps and outline the mission and goal. They chose Bob Aloysius and Mike Williams as interim co-chairs, while more members are expected to join. The long-term vision in some capacity includes equal footing among tribes, state, and federal managers. In the meantime, a federal demonstration project for co-management could build capacity for the change. Gene Peltola Jr., the Assistant Regional Director for the Federal Office of Subsistence Management, described a potential new committee under the Federal Subsistence Board. He says if it's structured properly, rural residents could have more input.
But if they were to give it, say, weighted opinion or whatever you want to call it, with that being said is that I truly feel that the local individual would have a lot more say in management than they have had in the past.
Sky Starkey, an attorney who works for AVCP, presented a vision of how the committee could push the boundary of the law in order to maximize the co-management potential. To give it teeth, Starkey says tribes should seek broad application of a section of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, that governs subsistence on federal lands. That could force the federal board to defer to their committee's plan unless the proposal fails to meet strict criteria.
Trying to use that and trying to strengthen it so that the recommendations carry a lot of weight.
One idea is to create a new regional advisory council that replaces the fish responsibilities of two current regional committees. In the very preliminary conception, tribes would make comprehensive management plans and take responsibility for researching and monitoring fish while giving traditional knowledge equal footing. A meeting for Yukon tribes is scheduled for next week in Fairbanks. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The state has proposed purchase of Fairbanks natural gas as part of a plan to increase the volume of Cook Inlet gas available in the interior. The governor has indicated that could begin as early as next year, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the timeline may stretch out longer.
Getting larger quantities of Cook Inlet gas to Fairbanks will likely take a while.
I think several years, potentially, would be a reasonable estimate.
That's State Oil and Gas Division Acting Director Paul Decker. Decker met with local leaders at the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation this week to brief them on Cook Inlet gas potential. Decker stressed that currently developed fields cannot ramp up to meet Fairbanks' demand.
Really going to rely on bringing on new fields.
Decker points to the new Cosmopolitan field in Cook Inlet, targeted by California-based Westpac for LNG.
For any of that gas to basically be the feedstock for the Fairbanks market, we need to see that gas field developed.
Decker outlined a multi-year plan that begins with onshore oil production, followed by gas extraction. The project also requires construction of an LNG processing plant, as well as train, truck, and barge transportation options to get the gas to communities, including Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A strong and freezing cold wind cut through Haines and Skagway yesterday and today. Gusts reached up to more than 100 miles per hour, and with temperatures in the single digits, the wind chill was at least 20 below. KHNS's Margaret Friedenauer takes us into the middle of the unusual southeast weather.
I'm standing outside the Chilkat Center in Haines, where my fingers are already numb, and when the big gusts of wind come by, it's a little difficult to keep my balance. There's small debris and branches flying by. And looking out over Lynn Canal, the water is mostly white with waves and freezing spray. We stopped to warm up at Sarah Jaymount's coffee shop downtown, where she was dressed in several layers to serve her customers at the walk-up window.
We were opening the window yesterday, and today it felt like we had just gotten out of the shower with wet head.
Despite the hurricane force winds, Haines and Skagway officials say no one has reported damage or downed trees, mostly because the freezing ground has helped solidify the root systems. But the wind did keep harbor employees busy. Here's harbor assistant Mark Allen.
We've been adjusting lines yesterday and today quite a bit. There's about every third or fourth boat has maybe a line that is stretched out a little further than it's used to. And so we just have been resetting lines out there, and one of them was broke.
The state canceled the ferry that was supposed to sail to Haines and Skagway today because of the strong winds and freezing spray. The ferry would have had to sail by Eldred Rock Lighthouse in the Lynn Canal, which registered wind gusts overnight of 114 miles per hour. Reporting in Haines with help from Emily Files, I'm Margaret Friedenauer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. The deadline is March the 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Shady Grove Oliver. This week on AK, climate change and the quest. The Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race starts tomorrow. For more than 30 years, the race course has followed an old Gold Rush-era trail that took advantage of the Yukon River. But in recent years, some parts of the river haven't frozen up. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, warm temperatures are starting to impact everything from race logistics to the sled dogs themselves.
A little open water on the Yukon Quest Trail is nothing new, but in recent years, wide open leads along the Yukon River have shaken even the toughest mushers.
And I was sleeping in my sled bag and I heard a roar sound like a freight train.
Last year, Hank DeBrune of Ontario stopped along the river about halfway through the race to rest his team for a few hours in the middle of the night.
So I threw all my stuff in the sled bag, pulled my dogs and my sled up the bank a bit and turned around, and it was wide open water where the sled had been sitting 5 minutes earlier.
DeBrune is shy and soft-spoken, but resilient. During our interview, he rubbed his dry, cracked hands on the table. Earlier, he told his wife he, quote, stared the devil in the face that night. Mushers have plenty of anecdotal evidence for warming temperatures and its impact on their sport. Cody Strath of Fairbanks says warmer temperatures and lacking snow have changed how he trains his team.
Normally dogs like to run at colder temperatures, usually like below zero. So we try to run more at night. So they have those nice cold temperatures, which they tend to like more with their big fur coats.
When I caught up with Strath, he was using a meat saw to cut up frozen chunks of beef and tripe, snacks for his dog team during the race. Eventually all that meat was packed into drop bags and sent out to checkpoints along the trail. He says it's nerve-wracking to relinquish all that food.
Because if it's, you know, really warm out, our meat can thaw and spoil, and then that is bad for the dogs. They can get sick or have nothing to eat, and so we have to package our food in ways that it will stay cold longer.
This year, he insulated his bags with bubble wrap to keep them frozen. Other mushers add blocks of ice or even snow. Mushers are also packing drop bags for a wider variety of trail conditions. In recent years, they've tossed rubber boots and chest waders into their sleds in anticipation of open water. They've also packed rain gear. National Weather Service climatologist Rick Toman says there will come a day when climate change delivers a serious blow to Alaska's state sport.
At some point in the future, we will reach a point where this starts to affect the ability to have these races. Whether this is in 5 years or 50 years or 100 years is an open question. But eventually it has to.
But Toman isn't quite ready to attribute current warm weather entirely to a changing climate.
Well, I think the way to think about this is a warming climate is kind of the background noise. And that's gradually getting louder over the years and decades. Sometimes it's even louder than it should be, and other times it seems to almost go away.
In fact, some of that noise impacted mushing even early on. Alex Olison is the Yukon Quest race manager. His father was involved with the race back when it started in 1984. Olison, now in his mid-30s, says there were years when he was a kid when mushers' drop bags actually did thaw out.
And it was like, that's a very distinctive memory out of my childhood, is like all these food drop bags like dripping with salmon, like blood and juice and everything. And we were like, Dad, we don't want to help them. Sorry. And he's like, yeah, I understand, kid.
He says there's always been a wide variety of weather-dependent contingency plans.
But now we're having to think about them almost every year. And it's the like frequency of it that has changed.
This year, Yukon Quest officials considered moving the start line because of open water on both the Yukon and Tokini Rivers near Whitehorse. A last-minute drop in temperatures and a snowstorm gave race personnel a reprieve. Mushers are hoping for a smooth run, but their sleds are packed just in case of whatever the trail may throw at them. For AK, I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Leavelock on the Kvijak River near Bristol Bay.
My name is Jadeline Washington. I am a
administrative assistant at the Leaf Lock Village Council in Leaf Lock, Alaska. Oh, it's up the mouth of Bristol Bay called Quijack River. It's Leaf Lock's on the bank of the river. There's 80 to 100 residents living here. A lot of people hunt, fish, trap. There's the Leaf Lock Packing Company, which should be in operation in 2016. It's going to be a cannery. The commercial fishermen, they go to Naknek and they fish down there every year for 2 months, or about 2 months, and they come back home for after commercial fishing is over. People that stay here in Leaf Lock all summer long, they do subsistence fishing, where you set out a net off the beach and you could either can them, salt them, or smoke them. Wintertime, they travel up the river, ice fish if the river is frozen. I like to live in Leaf Lock because it's more freedom.
Chadlin Washington is an administrative assistant in Leaf Lock. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Emily Schwing, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Margaret Friedenauer in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, which began on January 21st, encouraging early bird proxy submission by Friday, February 13th. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Enroll now in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly costs and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the health insurance marketplace. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.